Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
As a census follow-on product, kind of the reason that we do that, the reason we define it that way, is we use that overarching census of agriculture almost like a screener. We're looking at everybody across agriculture, learning about them. So one of the benefits is it tells us who is involved in this space. And so that kind of tells us who we needed to reach out to.
Lance Honig with USDA's National Ag Statistics Service.
You think about it, in general, our target audience is going to be folks that operate in this space and sold $10,000 or more of these horticultural specialty products, in this case during 2024. We actually sent out forms to about 40,000 operations nationwide back in December of 24. So folks are actively right now completing these forms, largely online. And we've got a deadline out there February 14th for folks to get those back in.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Now, why am I here? Because Trump won.
South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham on the nomination of Scott Bessent to be Treasury Secretary.
I wouldn't be here if Trump hadn't won. Trump won because more people voted for him. And he had to pick people to form his cabinet. And when he talked about the Secretary of Treasury, I'm not the normal person you would go to ask about, because this is not so much my portfolio. But when he mentioned Scott, I said, oh, my God, home run from my point of view. I mean, you talk about somebody who's academically gifted, understands the world. Scott, like any Republican president, would pick Scott. I mean, he's really understands the president and what the president wants to do. And the reason I vote for almost everybody, for every president, is I believe colleagues, that every president deserves a cabinet that they know and trust and can rely upon. If I had to vote for people based on agreeing with them, I wouldn't vote for anybody y'all picked. That's not the standard for me. I vote for people who I disagree with because I think they're qualified. So I would just ask the committee to think for a minute, is this man qualified? Does he have the background and the intelligence and the character to serve President Trump and our nation's Secretary of Treasury? I think by any reasonable test of qualifications, he excels beyond the bare minimum to the highest level of excellence. But that's just my opinion.
Bessent talks about the American dream and the dollar.
I've been blessed with a fulfilling and successful career, but my presence here today was far from predetermined. I was born and raised in the South Carolina Lowcountry. My father fell into extreme financial difficulty when I was young. When I was 9 years old, I started working two summer jobs, and I haven't stopped working since. I eventually made my way to Yale. I accepted my first internship in finance because the job came with a pull-out sofa in the office to sleep on, which allowed me to live in New York City, rent-free. I've been involved in the financial markets ever since. I've been fortunate enough to work with some of the world's greatest investors in a career that has taken me to almost 60 countries over 40 years. My life has been the Only in America story that I am determined to preserve for future generations. Today, I believe that President Trump has a generational opportunity to unleash a new economic golden age that will create more jobs, wealth, and prosperity for all Americans. My life's work in the private sector has given me a deep understanding of the economy and markets. And while this experience will be invaluable in crafting economic policy, I have long adhered to the principle that you should know what you don't know and lean on those who do. Having never served in government, I intend, if confirmed, to be in close contact with each of you in your offices and seek your counsel. The Treasury Department plays a critical role in protecting American national security. We must secure supply chains that are vulnerable to strategic competitors, and we must carefully deploy sanctions as part of a whole-of-government approach to address our national security requirements, and critically, we must ensure that the U.S. dollar remains the world's reserve currency.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Should you be an advocate? Should you post on social media? Should you do this? How do you decide?
Dan Ventiker is a social media sensation known as Iowa Dairy Farmer.
I'm not one that I'm going to tell you that you have to. Now, I'm going to say if you think you can, try it. You should. I think you should try if you want to, but I'm never going to be the one that says you have to do it, because it's not for everybody. And how do you decide to do it? You need to ask, where's your home? And what I mean by that is, like, when you have just a moment of free time, you have just any moment of free time, any moment of not distraction, kids are asleep, whatever, where's your brain go? If the first place your brain goes is your phone, because you have free time, your phone is your home. But here's the deeper part of that. Every app wants to be your home.
Ventiker, speaking recently at the American Farm Bureau Federation's annual convention, says, know the dangers.
We're distracting ourselves into mental oblivion with social media. And like I said, I don't want everybody to go home and like, oh crap, I got to delete all of this. Like, no, like, because you're still going to find another way to distract yourself. If you just go delete all your social media apps, well, then you're just going to distract yourself with Netflix, or you're just going to distract yourself with YouTube. So a lot of this, if you want to have a handle on these things, you got to learn how to tell yourself no, because here's the important part. A lot of people think, well, I scroll all the time and I'm fine. And it's fine until it's not. You can smoke cigarettes every single day until you're 70 years old, and it's fine until it's not. You can overconsume alcohol every single day, and it's fine until it's not. And that's what happened to me in 2023. I thought I had to consume in order to create. And it was fine until it wasn't. So we have to learn to tell ourselves no. And I can tell you, breaking the addiction from social media is not fun. For me, it looks like cold showers, fasting 2 days a week, setting a 30-minute timer, telling myself no on going out to, you know, places with people because I got to get enough sleep. So breaking free of a social media addiction, to be quite honest, is not a lot different than the other addictions when you think of alcohol or cigarettes. So the social media, what it does, I mean, it's playing into the dopamine in our brains, and we need to look at the way we handle our social media addictions, and we need to take our attention span back. Like, we need to take our minds back from these platforms and these apps, because if we can control ourselves and our habits on social media, and we can do it when we want to do it, you'll be a better creator. And that's what I tell people. It's like, if you want to be a content creator, absolutely you have to try it, but you have to be disciplined. And that's the big point I want to get across to anybody who's thinking about being an ag advocate, is absolutely try it and do it, but like, don't let it consume you. Because too many people put their self-worth and how many views did I get? How many followers am I gaining? Because that's, I mean, you kind of tend, it's human tendency in a way. You know, if I look at other ag influencers and they're always getting more views, it's like, well, what am I doing wrong? Well, it's like, it probably has nothing to do with you. And it's just the algorithm. The algorithm is a nasty mistress. And sometimes it will not reward really, really good videos. And then all of a sudden you think it's your fault.
And he has a warning about a restless thumb.
But my last point that I want everybody to consider is, a restless thumb leads to a restless soul. So right now it might be fine. You might be scrolling 3 hours a day, and that 3 hours a day, for me, it was like 3 to 4 hours a day. So you think, oh, Dan's just sitting on his couch for 3 hours straight. That's not what it is. It's, here's 10 minutes while a cow is waiting to go into the robot. Oh, the kids are done with their supper and everybody's quiet. I'll take 10 minutes. Oh, I'm sitting on the toilet. Here's 20 minutes. And then, the kids are in bed. Here's an hour. It all adds up. And that all still counts to overconsumption. And so it's fun right now. And I want to caution you, it's okay until it's not. So to be a better creator, we have to limit our consumption. To be a better influencer, we have to limit our consumption. To better tell our story as agriculture, we have to be disciplined with our consumption. Because if we don't, a restless thumb leads to a restless soul.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
An untended forest is no different than an untended garden. It will grow until it chokes itself to death, and then it will succumb to disease, pestilence, drought, and ultimately catastrophic fire. This is how nature gardens.
California Representative Tom McClintock during a House debate on the Fix Our Forest Act.
She doesn't care that it takes a century or more for a forest to regrow. We mortals do. Excess timber will come out of the forest in only two ways. Either we will carry it out, or nature will burn it out. That's why we created the Forest Service, to do our own gardening and remove excess timber before it can choke off the forest. Every year, foresters would mark off surplus timber, and we'd auction it off to logging companies who paid us to remove it. For a century, we enjoyed healthy, fire-resistant, and resilient forests. But then we passed bureaucratic laws that have made the active management of our forests all but impossible. A simple forest management plan now takes an average of 5.3 years to complete, and it costs millions of dollars, more than the value of the timber to be harvested. Since these laws were passed, timber harvested from the federal lands in California has fallen 75%, with a concomitant increase in acreage destroyed by fire.
But Don Beyer, a representative from Virginia, warns it's actually a vote against the Endangered Species Act.
I rise in opposition to the Fix Our Forests Act, and I rise to fight what could be the first successful attempt to undermine the Endangered Species Act. I believe that the California people deserve our urgent support to recover and rebuild from the tragic wildfires. And I'm disappointed that this was not a productive discussion, bipartisan discussion, to help address what they need. There are many excellent pieces of legislation that we should be looking at for that support, including many that are bipartisan, like the Modernization Wildfire and Safety and Prevention Act. Those bills provide much-needed funding, deliver desperately needed support to firefighters, and address the needs of frontline communities. This bill does not. Instead, it regurgitates long-held logging industry priorities to reshape environmental laws on Forest Service land and allow profit, not science, to dictate forest management decisions. As a co-chair of the Endangered Species Caucus, I am particularly troubled by this bill's rollback of the Endangered Species Act enforcement by overturning the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals Cottonwood decision. This decision basically says that when new science is emerged or develops on endangered species, it must be considered in Endangered Species Act protections. By the way, the science goes both ways. It can both identify new dangers, but it can also identify successes and reduce stresses to threatened species. The industry has long tried to include this so-called cottonwood fix in several pieces of must-pass legislation, most recently in the Farm Bill. And they now see, in the response to the California wildfires, their newest opportunity to undermine cottonwood. This industry wish list item would exempt federal land management agencies from reconsultation under the Endangered Species Act. That process ensures the federal agency's land management plans incorporate the best available science as it becomes available. It is absolutely essential, but this is also a rare occurrence. It doesn't happen very often. When it does, it's important to consider it. As any student of history of science knows, our shared knowledge is continuously evolving through new inquiry and discovery. If we didn't incorporate new knowledge, we'd still be stuck with the geocentric model of the galaxy, placing the Earth at the center of the universe. Or think about the modern medical system. The modern medical community is built off 19th century germ theory, which has saved hundreds of millions of lives. Incorporating new scientific knowledge is the bedrock of our modern society. It makes no sense when new science emerges to close our eyes, put our hands over the ears, and deny what the best science tells us.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I will immediately begin the overhaul of our trade system to protect American workers and families.
President Trump at the inauguration talking tariffs.
Instead of taxing our citizens to enrich other countries, we will tariff and tax foreign countries to enrich our citizens. For this purpose, we are establishing the External Revenue Service to collect all tariffs, duties, and revenues. It will be massive amounts of money pouring into our treasury, coming from foreign sources.
Ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee from Oregon, Ron Wyden, at a confirmation hearing for Scott Bessent, Treasury Secretary.
Donald Trump, with no plan and no strategy, says he's going to put across-the-board tariffs, blanket tariffs, on all imported goods, which means that our workers and our small businesses are going to get clobbered with additional taxes on practically everything they buy from other countries. My question here is, who would pay these tariffs, Americans or foreign countries?
So, this Senator Wyden, just to understand, so I can frame the answer correctly, do you believe that these tariffs are a consumption tax increase?
I believe these tariffs, you can call it whatever you want in terms of trying to gussy it up, They're going to be paid for by our workers and small businesses. And all through the campaign, we heard they weren't, that foreign countries were going to pay it. I think that's baloney. It's going to be paid for by workers and small businesses. So, your response.
Yes, Senator, I would respectfully disagree. And the history of tariffs and tariff theory, optimal tariff theory, does not support what you're saying. Traditionally, we see that the current, if we were to say, use a number that has been thrown around in the press of 10%, then traditionally the currency appreciates by 4%, so the 10% is not passed through. Then we have various elasticities, consumer preferences may change. And finally, foreign manufacturers, especially China, which is trying to export their way out of their current economic malaise, they will continue cutting prices to maintain market share.
Okay. That's an academic view of it. But what I know is the history of this is it clobbers people of modest means. They're the people who are going to get hit. And all through the campaign, there was a big show that it was going to be paid for by foreigners. Not so. Two other questions that I want to get in. And I already made it clear, and you and I talked about this. I'm for a tax code that gives everybody the opportunity to get ahead. You and I talked about my friend Bill Bradley. He and I have been working for this for years. Do you believe the tax code should treat wages differently than it treats wealth?
Look, in any tax system that advantages and creates distortions, it is a change that, Senator, it is a decision that was made when the tax codes were written. And so every tax code involves the trade-offs and distortions in favor of other the gains.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
If you have 20 minutes of free time, they want to be your attention.
Speaking at Farm Bureau's annual convention, Dan Ventiker, known online as Iowa Dairy Farmer.
Real quick, what I don't want everybody to do after I'm done with this last section is go delete all their social media apps, okay? But I do want to really caution against the dangers of social media, because we've seen it in my life firsthand, because all of these apps are coming for every second of your life. YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, they're coming for every single second of your life. Because if you have 20 minutes of free time, they want to be on it. That's how they make money. Your mind is a commodity to these people. And we give ourselves up to them, and our distractions and our minds, we give that up to them because we enjoy it. We distract ourselves too much. So what happened to me in 2023 when I took the latter half of the year off of posting is I was really anxious. I was stressed. I didn't get to the point of a depression, but I could see it coming. And I didn't know why. I'm a 32-year-old man. Why am I struggling with anxiety? Why is it hard just to go out and try to change an oil filter? Like, why can't I do my job that I've been doing my entire life? Like, why is this hard now all of a sudden? And I wanted to try all these other things to get rid of my anxiety. And I finally figured out, like, this is what anxiety feels like. This is what people talk about when they talk about anxiety. And we talk about all these things that are great about social media, and there are a lot of great things, but we don't stop and ask, like, is this good for me? Is this good for us? Because I tried a lot of stuff to fix my anxiety. But a lot of it was like putting on a nicotine patch and keep them smoking anyways. Like, these things don't fix it when the root problem was overconsumption. So I tried diet, exercise, different hobbies, you name it. But social media is what was making my anxiety worse. So, like, going into 21, it was fun. Going into 22, it was blowing up. And so I thought, okay, I got to keep going. I got to keep scrolling. I got to keep consuming. I got to keep creating. And then in 23, that's when that really started to catch up with me. And so, again, the anxiety got really bad. I just couldn't focus. I was distracted. And then I'd medicate with dopamine on my phone. And then because I was medicating with dopamine, I didn't really like doing my job as much. And because I didn't like doing my job as much, I would medicate with dopamine on my phone. And it was a vicious circle. So here's what I want to get across. This is my big point about social media, is that if we don't regulate our consumption, it will consume us. And that's what happened to us in 2023. And I mean this, that I would rather go through cancer and chemotherapy again than I would go through anxiety. Social media did more for my anxiety than cancer did. And that's where I try to, whenever I have an opportunity to talk to young people, I want them to understand, like, social media is fun. Like, do the stupid dance. Like, do the stupid trend. I did one yesterday with Dairy Girl Fitness and Zoe Kent. Like, it's fun. It's led to some great opportunities. Like, look at the consumers we've been able to reach. We reach on average like 10 to 15 million people a month. So we can do a lot of really cool things. But what I've seen in the latter half of 2024, and especially here in 2025, is I'm on social media the less I've ever been, and I'm creating the best content I ever have, and I'm getting the most views I ever have. So how I do it is I treat my screen time, I mean, I treat it like a job in a way, but my social media timer is set like 30, 40 minutes a day. So when that 30 minute timer goes off, I'm done. So I'm more intentional when I am on social media. So when I have 30 minutes, I know I'm going to find the creators I want to follow. I'm going to go look up the things I need to look up. But then I will take 10, 15 minutes and I will just casually scroll because it is fun. I mean, there are really good joys that come from being on social media, and there are some really good opportunities. But we have to learn how to tell ourselves no. And that, it was where the turning point was for me in 2024. Was anytime something went wrong in the farm, I'd go on my phone. Anytime something was stressing me out with milk production, I'd just go on my phone. I gotta relax. I gotta rest a little bit here and scroll. And that's what I would do. But that's not rest, because we're distracting ourselves into mental, physical, and spiritual oblivion.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
What happened in Los Angeles this month is a national tragedy. And in moments like this, we should overcome all politics and find ways to work together on solutions that actually help the people we're here to serve.
California Representative Jared Huffman.
I want to discourage any of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle who might want to embrace this wrong-headed idea that relief and support for Los Angeles can somehow be a bargaining chip or used as leverage to advance other policy goals. You're not going to turn California into a red state by hijacking critically needed disaster relief. And in fact, a thought like that never would have crossed our minds when we had the back of the people in Florida and North Carolina and Louisiana, and when we have simply been fellow Americans helping each other in the face of these terrible tragedies. That's the way it's always worked in this Congress, and I hope we're not going to set a terrible new precedent now.
But Texas Representative Chip Roy says at the end of the day, spending has to be paid for.
We right now have 36 point whatever trillion dollars in debt. Right now we are racking up about $1.8 to $2 trillion a year in deficits. When the interest on the bonds that we currently hold are getting refinanced over the next couple of years, those interest payments are going to go up, probably to the tune of another $200 to $300 billion a year. If we renew all of the tax cuts, which I support, but we don't offer any cuts correspondingly, we will add hundreds of billions, if not several trillion dollars of deficit spending. So the job for us, Republicans and Democrats, is to not do that. And I'm asking for deficit neutrality on the tax bill. Let me just be clear. If I win that fight, if all my colleagues who want deficit neutrality or deficit reduction on the tax bill combined with spending cuts being debated in reconciliation right now, if I win that fight that I'm having right now with colleagues, you're like, oh, I don't know. The best we'll get is the current deficit. That's how we would end up with exactly what we have right now of roughly $2 trillion deficits. By the way, it'll get worse because of the interest I told you about. As we keep refinancing our debt, and interest goes up. So what I'm trying to scrap for in this body is just trying not to make it worse. It's like Christmas vacation. Yeah. Worse? How can it get any worse? I'll tell you how it can get worse. Vote for more deficits. So we shouldn't do that. And my actual last point, with I think a minute and a half remaining, is that if we're going to do anything at all in reconciliation on policy, we should be fighting for healthcare freedom. My office put out a report 2 days ago called The Case for Healthcare Freedom. It's 48 pages that outlines all of the ways in which we are destroying the average American's access to healthcare, that we need to restore the doctor-patient relationship, that we need to break down the stranglehold that insurance companies and hospitals and pharma have on our healthcare. free them up with expansive health savings accounts, allow them to decouple that so they can go out in the market and get actual insurance, go to direct primary care, and actually get care for themselves instead of paying $25,000 a year between their employer and themselves to be able to go to an insurance company and be told that they can't get care. So if we want to transform this country, reduce the deficits, give the president what he needs to secure the border, and give us health care freedom. And that's my call to my colleagues.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The product category receiving the most attention within USDA's January food price outlook, eggs. Economist Megan Schweitzer says
egg prices rose by 8.4% in December. That was due to ongoing effects of the avian influenza outbreak that's been going on since 2022. Egg prices in December were up 36.8% from last year, but those prices are still below where they were at the peak of the outbreak at the beginning of 2023.
And as for the forecast for egg prices for 2025,
we are predicting egg prices to increase by 20.3%.
Another product category of interest in the latest food price outlook.
Prices for beef and veal declined in December by 0.2%, but prices were up by 4.9% from last December.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.